If you create a stem cell, the stem cell can become anything. It can become a cancer, unfortunately, if it's not regulated properly. When your body starts with stem cells, it has a very well-defined way of turning your cells into specific tissue types like the liver and the brain and so forth. But when you do it in the middle of nowhere, out of nowhere, it doesn't really know how to handle that, and it can become a cancer cell.
Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blander joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question, how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Gil Blander, and welcome to Longevity by Design, How to Live a Longer, Healthier Life. We are produced by InstaTracker, your science-based guide to optimize your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. Noah Davidson. Dr. Davidson is the co-founder and chief scientific officer of Rejuvenate Bio, a gene therapy company pioneering novel therapies for chronic age-related diseases. Noah is an expert in translation, age reversal research, and technologies to utilize recombinant DNA, genetic therapies, viral vector production, and advanced model of disease and aging. Noah received his PhD in biological engineering at MIT and joined the Joe Church Lab as a postdoctoral fellow, where he focused on breakthrough genetic therapies for age-related diseases. He has over 10 years of expertise designing and conducting laboratory studies with numerous publications. Thank you for being here today, Noah.
Thanks for having us.
Excellent. So, Noah, it's a great pleasure for me to have you today. And usually we start the discussion by asking our guest to provide a brief introduction about himself and also what drove you to become a scientist.
I think I'm your pretty classic sci-fi nerd, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars, Stargate, you know, all the cool science shows, science fiction TV shows and movies, the superhero shows and movies, I think really drove me to get into science and create the impossible, take what seems like science fiction today and turn it into something that we can actually do tomorrow. So originally I wanted to be an astronaut and travel the universe and come up with a new space travel, and then I quickly realized that I was not smart enough at Caltech to actually do the physics necessary to achieve that space travel. So I turned towards something that I thought I was much better at, which was bioengineering. And that's what I did my PhD in. And that's what I continue to work in today.
Excellent. Thank you. And as a founder and chief scientific officer of a different company, I'm always fascinated about how a person decided to found the company and how is it to be a chief scientific officer of a biotech company.
Yeah, it's stressful. It's a lot of work. Very rewarding, though. The way I decided to start a company was because that is the best way to get what we were working on where it needed to go. I don't think the translational aspects of gene therapy can really stay in an academic environment for too long. We had to turn it into a company to achieve the goal of translating the genetic therapies into the people and patients that need them the most. And so that's kind of the genesis of why it had to turn into a company. What really inspired me was actually my dog Bear. I got him as a puppy in the first 6 months of my postdoc, and it really refocused me to come up with the idea that eventually ended up being Rejuvenate Bio, because I wanted to make him live longer and healthier. And transgenic animals and people is not something that is practical from a therapeutic standpoint and not something that we generally like to do. I think coming up with therapies that we can give older individuals and animals that have the ability to decide if they want to take it is a much better place to be. And the older populations are really the patients who need these types of therapeutics the most. So coming up with something that we can actually give to them as a therapy was really what drove me, because Bear was already born and our older patient population with the same thing. We need to come up with something we can give to them. And that's what kind of focused me on. the path to creating Rejuvenate.
Excellent. And they're very interesting because maybe it's the first time that I'm hearing that your pet drove you to start a company. It's very interesting. But I know another person, Matt Kepperlein, I'm sure that you know him as well, that actually started a company to also to help dogs live longer. So it sounds like it's in fashion right now to help our four-leg friends to live longer. It's a good...
Well, it's a good cause. It's also highly overlapping because they have the same age-related diseases that we do. They live with us. We care about them, their family to us. And, you know, we should have more therapeutics available to them as well as to us. But yeah, treating the diseases of aging is the key goal here.
So before we dive into gene therapy and what you do at the Rejuvenate, we would like to start and discussing a bit epigenetics. And for our audience that don't know a lot about epigenetics, how can you explain it?
Epigenetics is the layer that is controlling what parts of your DNA are on or off. So the same DNA is in your neurons, is in your skin cells, is in your liver, except different parts of that genetic program are on in those different cell types. And epigenetics is the way to control which genes are on and off. They're also part of our development cycle. How we go from a baby to an adult takes us through the different parts of development through turning on various genetic programs. And once we reach adulthood, the goal is to maintain the current state of genetic program.
Okay. And can you explain the difference between epigenetic and genetics and why epigenetic is reversible and the genetic is not?
Yeah, the genetics are not generally changing as you age, and epigenetics are that layer on top of the genome. So they're specific chemical marks either on histones, which control DNA, or the DNA methylation itself. And these marks, these chemical marks, can be put on or taken off or fall off or become dysregulated over time. And so epigenetics is fungible, whereas your genetics, for the most part, unless you're doing CRISPR editing or that sort of thing, are pretty much permanent. And so it's much easier to interact at the epigenetic level to change what is already changing throughout our lifetime.
Thank you for that. And you recently have been a co-author of a paper, I think a very interesting paper, together with the lab of David Sinclair, that look at a model of eye rejuvenation and basically show that you can reverse the aging and look also at epigenetics. Part of it was using the Yamanaka factors, which is assume that for most of our audience is a Japanese, and actually it is a Japanese scientist. So maybe let's start with that and explain to our audience what are Yamanaka factors?
Yeah, the Yamanaka factors are four genes that, maybe more than four depending how you define them, but a minimum set of four genes that are able to take an adult cell that is differentiated, say like a liver cell, and turn it into a pluripotent stem cell. And this was big news back when he discovered this minimal set of genes that allowed stem cells to be created from our tissues and potentially used for therapeutic applications. It also, there is a lot of convolution between aging and stem cell likeness. So if you take an adult cell and turn it into a stem cell, a lot of these new tools of measuring age are showing that being a stem cell is basically like being age zero. And so by being able to deconvolute cell identity and cell age, I think is a key goal of the field right now, which we can go into more a little bit later. But generally, the Yamanaka factors were the first minimal set of factors that were able to take adult cells and turn them into stem cells.
Okay.
Excellent. And make cells much younger.
Okay. And in that paper, again, the paper that you worked together with David Sinclair lab from Harvard, you used the OSK to basically reverse the process in the eye and also to make, a blind mice allow it to see again. So can you describe a bit what have you done? What what is the breakthrough in this paper?
Yeah, I definitely had a much more supportive role for this paper. It was led by the lead author, Yanchen Lu, and I helped mostly on the genetic therapy expertise. At the time, I was already working with AAV gene therapies and helped them develop the OSK gene therapy. But he really developed or led the effort to decide to go out to the optic nerve and reverse damage from the optic nerve there. But basically what we were able to show is that if you make the cells younger, they're able to heal from that optic nerve damage and still continue to function. Excellent. And so the gene therapy temporarily turns on OS and K, three of the Yamanaka factors, to de-age the cells. You don't want to have them on for too long because then you potentially could end up with a stem cell.
Okay. And I assume that when they stay as a stem cell, it can induce cancer, correct?
That is a possibility. If you create a stem cell, the stem cell can become anything. It can become a cancer, unfortunately, if it's not regulated properly. When your body starts with stem cells, it has a very well-defined way of turning your cells into specific tissue types like the liver and the brain and so forth. But when you do it in the middle of nowhere, out of nowhere, it doesn't really know how to handle that, and it can become a cancer cell. Having this control system, though, this inducible system that allows us to temporarily turn on OSK, obviate that safety factor, because you don't let them become stem cells by having it on for only a temporary period of time. So you're able to get a lot of the benefits of de-aging the cell without losing the cell identity. And so you keep a neuron, but it's a younger neuron now.
Okay. And very recently, you posted a manuscript at the BioArchive that a very exciting result that made a lot of noise in the world. You also had an article about it at MIT Tech Review that basically showed that you can take older mice and inject them again with those factors. And then what happened to them when you do that?
Yeah, I think the key thing here is that nobody had previously shown that normal wild-type mice, really old wild-type mice, could be rejuvenated, for lack of a better term, de-aged, age reversal, with these factors. What you saw with the collaboration with the Church Sinclair collaboration was we were able to show that optic nerve damage model, we're able to reverse the damage. Recently, Sinclair has also put out another paper that shows that they can reverse epigenetic damage that they induce with CRISPR. The first time that the Yamanaka factors were used in aging, it was a progeria model, which is not really an aging model, but yet another disease model. So I think the important thing that we were able to show is that normal, healthy, old mice can benefit and have increased life and health span using this therapy.
Yeah, that's really exciting for all of us, because they say that even when you are, I don't know how you compare them to the age of humans, but I would say, I don't know, 80 years old human or something like that, and you can still expand their lifespan. That was like 10, 15%, something like that. Cool.
Yeah, the remaining lifespan was doubled. The median lifespan was an extra 7, 8% increase overall. So if you theoretically were going to live 10 years, you live 20 years. And so, yeah, akin to an 80 or 90 year old person where we're doubling the remaining amount of their life. And I think what's key here is that you didn't have to do something your entire life to get that benefit. You don't have to eat right and exercise all the time. And then you eventually will get those extra 5 years, but you suffer by having to exercise and eat right for your whole life. Here, we're able to give a therapeutic at the end of your life and give you those extra, 10 years of disease-free, healthy years, hopefully, that everybody wants, and you didn't have to do anything previously to get there.
So I have a zillion questions about that. I don't want to take all the time, but one question that comes to mind, if you induce the Yamanaka factor longer, do you think that they will live longer, or do you think that it won't change and that's the maximum that you can expand it?
So I think there's a couple, this is definitely a proof of concept study. I think there's a couple different areas to be improved to potentially get improved results. So I'll first, the way we induced the Yamanaka factors is we turned them on for a week and then we'd had them off for a week and cycled for the rest of their life. I don't think just turning them on longer might be the benefit, like the first way I would try to get an increased benefit. Number one, getting it into more cells in the mice would probably be beneficial. And number two is making sure it's on in all those cells. So just reaching more cells and getting it on in all those cells, I think would be the first way we'd actually get an increased benefit. We used something called adeno-associated virus. It's a gene therapy vector, and it carried the payload of the Yamanaka factors. Because we do this inducible system where we don't have it on all the time, it's actually quite large, and we have to use two different viruses. So then both viruses have to get into the same cell. This, again, is decreasing the amount of cells that are getting the full therapeutic payload. Without both parts, it won't work. And so having a better inducible system would be key that can fit on the one vector. That will help us increase the ability to get to more cells, as well as better AAVs that can target more cells. AAV9 is the AAV subclass, subtype that we used for this experiment, which is pretty good, but it definitely doesn't get all your cells. So having a better AAV with a one vector instead of two will be very beneficial to get it into all the cells that's possible. Secondarily, the inducible system relies on doxycycline administration. This is an antibiotic. The antibiotic can't go everywhere and it can't get into every single cell. So even if you get the therapy into that cell, it's not necessarily going to be turned on because the doxycycline can't get there. So there's many levels that prevent every single cell from turning on this age reversal program. So the first thing I would do is get a better inducible system with a better inducer that can reach more cells, as well as a better AAV that can get into more cells and have only one AAV so that you can, again, get more cells. So I think those different things are going to get huge improvements in our ability to reverse aging and get more efficacy from that.
Yeah, thank you for that. And just for our listener, AAV is adeno-associated virus, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. My next question, and again, you don't have to answer it, is if you will try to inject or infect them earlier, would you predict that you will see a better effect? So my question is it possible to increase the lifespan of the mice by 2x instead of what you showed here, like it's around 10%?
It's possible. A lot of the data suggests, just in the aging field, that the earlier you intervene, the bigger the effect you have at the end of the life. It becomes a much longer experiment. So how long do you want the experiment to be is the question. So we wanted the experiment to be as short as possible and as applicable as possible, because generally the older population are the people who have the most age-related diseases and problems. And if we can apply it to our eldest, most sick population, then I think we're in the best possible scenario of being able to get these treatments to humans since we have that proof of concept data now.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Again, it's a very exciting experiment, and I think that it's give hope for all of us that we might be in a situation in the future that we might get infected. I'm not sure that it will be with AAV, but and then we can add another decade or so to our life, and it might still be in our lifetime. We assume that that's the goal of a company.
We're hoping to translate the epigenetic modification therapy in the next 3 to 5 years. So hopefully we'll be doing our first in human studies for specific age related disease in the next 3 to 5 years with these epigenetic age reversal technologies. I think the goal really is to be disease free, not necessarily live forever. And if we can get rid of all age related diseases, I think everybody will have a longer, healthier life. We may consequently live a lot longer, but I think the disease free years is the important part.
Absolutely. A health span is much more important than the lifespan. All of us agree with you. So your company, Rejuvenate Bio, is not only looking at the Yamanaka factor, you also are doing some gene therapy with a few different targets. And for my knowledge, most of the companies, let's say traditional gene therapy, are usually looking at one specific gene, one specific target, while Rejuvenate Bio is looking at the same time on I can see three different targets. So can you explain why you would like to look at a few at the time and not zooming in on one at a time?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple different things than what has been happening in the gene therapy space from what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to get our therapy into a lot more patients than you typically see in the gene therapy space. Instead of doing monogenic disorders where you know there's one particular gene that's a problem and fixing that one gene, we're actually going after complex diseases, the diseases of aging, with genes that have more far-reaching effects than that one particular gene. Because most of the age-related problems you have do not have a very specific defined etiology where you know exactly what genes are causing the problem. It's usually a myriad of genes or damage to the cells, et cetera. So we're taking age-related genes from the longevity field, FGF21 and TGF-beta. That's our first therapeutic, and trying to decrease TGF-beta1 and increase FGF21. This goes to our core thesis of what is actually happening with aging. And that's why the Aminoc factors are also interesting, because dysregulated gene expression over time is what we think is the core driver of age-related disease. And these two proteins are dysregulated, and we're trying to re-regulate them back to an earlier state. These are secreted proteins and have wide-ranging effects. And then the next generation of therapies, these Yamanaka factor-based therapeutics, where you're doing epigenetic modification, would actually be modifying thousands of genes at the same time. And so it's kind of a next level up, but it's more specific to be inside each individual cell, whereas the first therapy we have is secreted and can get to every single cell. So a little bit different, but the paradigm here is that we're re-regulating gene expression, and we're starting out with two proteins that can have wide-ranging effects across numerous different age-related diseases. And that's what the PNAS paper I published from my time in the church lab during my postdoc was showing, that these two genes, when in combination, can treat heart failure, kidney failure, diabetes, and obesity. And that's more along the line of, if you're actually going after things from an aging perspective, you're holistically treating a number of different things. And so that's why we're going at it a little bit differently. We're taking two genes that have wide-ranging effects, applying them to very specific age-related diseases, and then we hope to get into a lot of different patient populations so that they can all benefit from these this different approach.
Excellent. And just note for our listener, we discussed this paper in the past with Dr. Church in an earlier episode, so you're more than welcome to listen to that. But for you, Noah, can you elaborate a bit about what is FGF21 and what is TGF-beta1, and why have you decided to focus on that?
Yeah, I think the reason we focused on them is they have some of the bigger effects in longevity science. FGF21 was able to provide close to a 30% increase in life and health span in engineered mice that had overexpression of FGF21. And TGF-beta1 has been shown to have a 10-ish% increase in life, a decrease in TGF-beta1 has been shown to have a 10 to 15% increase in lifespan. And they're somewhat orthogonal. So that's why I like the combination of those two things. They're active, they're working on different pathways. FGF21 is generally known as the starvation hormone. If you eat less, you'll have more of this. Also, if you exercise more, you'll have more of this protein. It generally increases mitochondrial content, decreases growth hormone and IGF-1, and it can increase vascularization through adiponectin. So a lot of good health benefits. It also tells your body to use fat as an energy source. And so that's how it has a lot of its metabolic effects. TGF-beta1 is our target. We actually overexpress a receptor to bind up a lot of TGF-beta1. Generally, TGF-beta1 is expressed when there's damage and can cause fibrotic lesions to happen. It's part of the healing process, but if it goes on for too long, you get a lot of fibrosis and scar tissue that you don't want. So by decreasing TGF-beta1 in the long term, you actually stop this pleiotropic nature of scar tissue and fibrosis from forming, while FGF21 focuses on more of the health of the actual muscle cells and that sort of thing.
And when we interviewed Dr. Church a few months ago, he also mentioned that there was another target, alpha-klotho. So that's something that you are not working on anymore?
That's part of our second therapy, what we call RGBO2. So TGF-beta receptor 2 and alpha-clofo have been shown to work in heart failure, kidney failure, and osteoarthritis. And so clofo has also been shown in the literature to decrease cognitive decline and make some mice smarter. So I think there's a number of different applications for RGBO2 as well. I think osteoarthritis is our first target, but could potentially expand into other things. Alpha-clotho is secreted from the kidneys. It generally promotes cellular health in a number of different ways, but just you could think of it as cell protective.
And the next question is related, okay, what are the age-related diseases or what are the target that you are going to approach first and maybe why? I know that you touched it a bit before, but I think that it will be good for our audience to understand why and how and what are the reasons that the gene therapy company are approaching what kind of indication.
Yeah, our first RGBO1, the TGF-beta receptor and the FGF21 is targeting heart failure, both in dogs and people. In dogs, it's mitral valve disease. And in humans, it's arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, ARVC. This is the disease that you hear about when a young person, unfortunately, their heart just stops out of nowhere. It's because they have this arrhythmic event and their heart just stops beating. And so with a congenital disease, there's a number of different mutations that cause it. There are subpopulations within the disease. But this is a great place to start. I think there's a huge unmet need in this patient population. They don't have many medicines that can actually stop the progression of the disease, just more to deal with the symptoms of the disease. A lot of them have cardiac implants to stop the arrhythmias, you know, pacemakers. And that's the first target we're going to for humans is this heart failure disease. And then potentially we could go into other different heart diseases as well.
Thank you. And you mentioned dogs. So I don't know a lot of companies that working in parallel, I assume that you need FDA for treating dog as well. So can you explain a bit about your strategy? Why are you going in parallel on dogs and humans at the same time?
Yeah, the preclinical development for humans has a very large overlap with the clinical development for dogs. So you generally need to use a large animal model before you can go into humans. So you do mice, and then you have to do some large animal. And dogs are a great large animal to go into because the gene therapies work very similarly in dogs as they do on people. And a couple of the gene therapies that have already been approved for people actually show that they work in dogs first. So the approval from Spark Therapeutics had dogs that had the same eye problems that they used in humans. And they also have these hemophilia dogs that have been used as a model for human hemophilia that have been used as the model for the gene therapy development. So the reason that we are developing it for animals is because it's the same amount of work that we would have had to done for human development. But now we have partnered with Phibro Animal Health so that they can so we can focus on the human aspect. They can commercialize the therapy for dogs once we've done the experiments we were going to do anyway. And so I think gene therapy makes this more possible because you are creating a new key for each lock. And by that, I mean, you don't have one small molecule that you are applying to different species, which may interact with those different species in different ways. Here, you create a gene therapy for dogs and you test it in dogs with the dog genes. And then you create a gene therapy for humans with the human genes. And so they're bespoke for each species and the translatability is much higher, whereas a small molecule, that may not be true.
And just for curiosity, how different is the dog gene versus the human gene? Is it very small or there is a significant difference?
It depends on what angle you look at it. So immunologically, if you put the human genes in dogs, you would probably get an immune response and vice versa. If you put the dog genes in humans, you'll probably get an immune response. That being said, they're pretty similar from a genetic diversity perspective. They have about 85 to 90% homology between the proteins themselves. So they're very similar, but there are enough changes that it would make it a foreign protein if you put it into the wrong species.
You got it. Interesting.
And my next question is about the next indication. So it sounds like you are going into heart failure right now, but what if you think about the future, what will be the second indication and the next indication for maybe human and dogs?
Yeah, I think the metabolic aspects, as you've touched on previously, are kind of the logical different path for RJVO1. We've already shown really great effects in obesity and diabetes in the mouse models. And I think Ozempic and Wegovy have been making quite the news headlines lately. Obesity is a huge problem in the United States as well as diabetes. And FGF21 has huge effects in insulin sensitivity. So the mice with FGF21 had a much higher sensitivity to insulin. So you wouldn't have to take as much insulin or at all with FGF21, as well as it conditions our body to use fat first as a source of energy instead of carbohydrates. So you'd actually lose a lot of your fat. So I think the metabolic aspects are definitely the most interesting from a second perspective after the heart failure aspects.
Okay, that's good. And when do you envision that you can use the FGF treatment and the TGF-beta for treating aging? Or are you still waiting for the FDA to declare that aging is a disease and only then you will do that?
I still don't think there are really good biomarkers to, because you don't want to do a 10 or 20 year study.
Okay.
So instead of trying to go after aging yourself, which is just fraught with problems, I think coming at it from the disease perspective is really where you want to be. And how can we get rid of a lot of different diseases? And how can we get it to a lot of different people? Well, you go after diseases that are common to a lot of people. And so if you're starting to go after general heart failure and heart disease and general obesity and diabetes, you're talking about half of America. Most of these people have these diseases. And so if you're trying to get a therapy out there for longevity, one of the best ways is probably to get it to as many people as possible. And by going after these indications with very large patient populations, you're in some sense achieving the goal of a longevity therapeutic without having to have the label say longevity. And if we have really good safety profiles and we show a lot of prevention of a lot of these different diseases, then you can start to imagine that even healthy people could start to take these therapies. And I think that's the power of taking genes from the longevity field and creating therapies from them, is that they probably have some of the best safety profiles out there for a therapeutic, because they've already been shown to increase the health and lifespan of normal mice. So yeah. I think it's very promising that we could potentially give this to healthy individuals, because there aren't many drugs, if any, out there that you would take as a healthy person just for fun. So,
yeah. No, I hear you, but still, if we're going back to the manuscript that you submitted recently to BioArchive, and you show that, again, if I'm translating into human, let's say 80 years old person, so theoretically you can use that on 80 years old, and then the study won't be, at least as of today, won't be 20 years, but maybe it will be 5 years, and still you can see a difference, correct?
It would probably be longer than that. If you think about the practicality, you have to enroll patients, you have to follow them for a long period of time, and there's always drop-offs of numbers or other things that go wrong. So you still have to enroll a very large amount of people, and you'd have to follow them for a very long time comparatively for other drugs out there, because you usually have much more near-term quantifiable metrics. And even going after something like heart failure can take a very long time for any drugs. And it's hard to get kind of these drugs approved for much larger audiences. So I think it's a little impractical from a money and time perspective to still go after aging without proper biomarkers. You could wait for that 5 to 10 years, but it's more like 10 to 20 years, even if you were waiting only 5 years for a metric because of enrollment time and follow-up period and that sort of thing. So the number of patients combined with the time that you're following them is probably a very, very expensive trial, several $1 billion just to follow those patients in a phase 3. So I don't know if it's practical just yet without a proper biomarker. I think you would need a proper biomarker to run an aging specific trial.
But I think that it's a good take-home message for our audience. The clinical trial sounds easy and exciting, but as much as I know, a cost of a patient is around $10,000 or so. So if you need 1,000 patients, you're already close to $1 billion. And it's not an easy for a startup to do that.
No, definitely not easy for a startup. And depending on the size, it could start to become prohibitive for even some of these larger pharmaceutical companies. So,
yeah, that's a very good lesson for all of us. And my next question is related to what have you seen so far with your clinical studies? Again, if you can say, I know that sometimes you can and you can, but have you seen any indication that indeed there are improvement, the model organism or human with the gene therapy treatment that you are doing?
Yeah, the PNAS paper has some really exciting data on those different disease models. We have some new data internally that's showing some real excitement around ARVC, the first disease that we're going into for humans. We also have some exciting data that we haven't yet put out there for the dogs that we've treated with mitral valve disease. And these are dogs in the real world, not in a lab setting, that have naturally occurring mitral valve disease. And we're seeing some real promise in that data as well. And so I think there's a lot of exciting data that's going to come out sooner rather than later for these different disease models and naturally occurring diseases that are showing that our therapies are actually working and doing what they can do.
And what is the time span from today until the gene therapy that you're working on might be in market for dogs and for a human?
Yeah, we're aiming to have our first, the dog version of the therapy conditionally approved for mitral valve disease in 2024, and a similar time frame for having the therapy in the clinic for humans for ARVC. So both of those are lining up because, like I said, the experiments are the same thing that you have to do for both. And so we'll hopefully be in the clinic by the end of 2024 for humans, as well as selling into the animal health market, conditionally approved for mitral valve disease.
So in the clinic for human, that's mean phase one, or you will pass the phase?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Phase 1/2. Gene therapies generally aren't given to healthy people. They're given to sick people. So it's called a phase 1/2 study because you actually are using it on sick patients and getting partial efficacy.
Okay. So for dogs is a bit less than 2 years. For human, it will be in phase 1/2 in less than 2 years, which is pretty close. That's great.
Yeah. I'm excited.
Yeah. Finger crossed. I hope that it will work. And Noah, I would like to wrap up our discussion. And we always like to ask our guest about what is your top tip in improving health span? What would you recommend our audience as an expert in the field? What should they do in order to live better longer?
Yeah, I think right now without proper longevity type therapeutics, the best thing people can do is actually exercise and eat right so that you are around long enough to actually get some of these really exciting, promising age reversal therapeutics. Just making sure that you're healthy and staving off the diseases of aging. The best thing to do is to exercise and eat right. And that way you're going to have less age-related diseases and hopefully be here by the time we have these really impressive therapeutics.
Thank you. And anything the specific that you are doing in order to live better longer?
Just those two things. I surf, I bike to work, I work out, I run, I try to eat mostly vegetarian for the most part or pescatarian. You know, kind of the things that have been around for a very long time. Those seem to be working the best, and I feel great. But.
Okay, thank you so much. That's good, and I think that we are coming up on our time. So thank you so much, Noah, and we look forward to exploring the research in the field of longevity each month with you and leading scientists. For more information, please go to www.insighttracker.com/podcast. Again, thank you so much, Noah. That was fascinating.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by Inside Tracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit insidetracker.com/podcast.